when it comes afterwards and you're talking, you know, chums, etc., etc., there's the there's those who, you know, have got a story to tell that's, you know, horrendous, or, you know, they were sunk and stuck in amongst the oil for 3 hours before they were picked up. Well, I mean, that's something that's, you know, quite an experience. But the proportion of people who go through some sort of experience like that, although they didn't, is much less. And I was thinking, well, what are these medals anyway? You know, if you do something, you know, outrageously, what's the word, not daring,
right,
heroic, then you get a special medal. Otherwise, you get these campaign medals. But they are the reward, I think, for being there. Not for having done anything here, just for having been there and being likely to be subjected to some sort of hazardous circumstance.
Sydney Pickett, Reel 3. Can you tell me about life on a frigate and how it differs from life,
sorry,
on a big battleship?
Well, firstly, it's far more uncomfortable. It's far more crowded. You have to prepare. You have what we call canteen mess in. You get an allowance. So you've got eight on a mess. And you buy, there are goods on the ship, of course, that you buy. Or when you come into port, you can go and buy local stuff or whatever. You do your own catering for the mess, and one of the members of the mess is elected to be caterer. And anyone complains to him, he picks the books up and says, right, you do it. So you don't complain to the caterer if you get, no one wants the job. So that was one of the things, like the cooking. And it's generally uncomfortable and all that sort of thing, and you know, you're rolling about all the time, you know, and uncomfortable, and quite often you've got, you know, you're awash on the decks down below where the water comes down, and you know, all that sort of thing, and hasn't got the facilities of, you know, you haven't got any doctor on board. You might have a sick berth attendant, but not necessarily. So you've got a lot of restrictions.
You have a mess system, obviously.
Mm.
But the size of the size of your mess is different. So you have much less room.
Probably the square foot per person is not an awful lot of difference. Perhaps a little bit tighter, but basically, you know, you've got less space, you've got less bodies on a small ship. You know, you more or less equates between one and the other. On these convoys, we used to pick up convoys off the Clyde, and we used to go out into the Atlantic, then come south, then come back into Gibraltar, because we had to miss the French coast, because they had all the submarines there, and you know, coming out the Bay of Biscay, and that. So we had to go right out and come back down again. The convoys we picked up were called KMF, were fast convoys. We might have anything from, say, 10 to 20 liners, troop ships. And in those days, I could recognise at a distance and identify nearly every merchant liner on our side. You've got to know the shape of them and all this, that and the other. And we used to take them out into the Mediterranean, in the end up as far as Naples, for the, and there'd all be troops on board and all that sort of thing. And you know, sometimes we had to go alongside them to deal with something or other, whatever. But that was a thing that we did one period for quite a few months, a lot of months. We'd be going backwards and forwards from like Scotland to Italy. And when after D-Day, and they did all the submarine pens in on the west coast, we could then come down straight and not have to go out into the Atlantic, so that was quicker. But again, that was boring and routine. I mean, we had a few aircraft come over from time to time. But touch wood, sorry, we never lost a ship, which was something. Because they were fast, you see, they could go faster than a sub.
Do you have any You said that on the Duke of York there was quite a considerable number of signals,
Mm.
How many signals?
One leading signalman and three signalmen. So I went on there as a signalman. I was a senior signalman. And I left there when I was promoted to leading signalman. So that was it, leading signalman and three signalmen. So you're on continuous, you know, one in three watches, but then this was a general thing on destroyers and escorts and all those sort of things. They had a different life to battleship. It was more routine. You had your duty watches, and then you had your dawn and dusk action stations. You closed up, and you know, whatever dawn came could be 4 o'clock in the morning, could be 8 o'clock, but you closed up dawn and dusk for ready prepare for action stations, in addition to doing your watches. And then in addition to the times you turn out for actual action stations, which whenever you went into attack a submarine, you went into action stations. So that was another thing, you know, on small ships you spent a lot more time on duty, on watch, than you would on a larger ship.
What was your role during the time that you were attacking the submarines?
Well, getting messages from the, you often went in with two of you, you know, so communicating, being giving the other person your reading of where the submarine was and blah, 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 and what you're going to do and all that sort of thing. It's not easy locating and sinking a submarine. There are so many complications. And very often you sink one and don't know it, you know, and vice versa. So, yes, these were the problems, that you spend an awful lot of time awake. But somehow you, and you know, and you'd be all wet and cold or hot and sweaty or whatever it might be. You just lived with it, you just took it. I mean, that's like I say, these medals come through for being there, for going through all the hazards and hardships without having your head blown off. You just sort of soaked it up, I think. I mean, you were conditioned, I think. You were numb. When it got horrible, you just went into sort of retracted into dealing with what was going on. Knowing all the time, any minute you could hit a mine or a torpedo would hit you. I mean, that was there all the time. And that's why I think you got your campaign medals, for the fact that you were being subjected, or could become subjected, to some horrible experience.
When you were on jury, sank two submarines, were there any survivors that were picked up by your ship?
No. What happened, you claim, and that you, because you heard of the Aztecs where you get the ping ping, you know what I mean? When that stops, it should mean that you sunk the submarine and that's it, but it's not necessarily. But after the war, the Germans had records of their submarines which were sunk and when, and the Admiralty, and I suppose the Germans, they mixed all this information together and confirmed that on that date this submarine was sunk, and on that date the Drury and the Calder were in joint action in sinking a submarine. They claimed a submarine and that confirmed it, or otherwise.
When did you leave the jury?
When I was made leading sig, which I think was the end of 44. Probably about September, October 44. October or November. Towards the end of 44, I went back to the barracks in Plymouth, and I was immediately given a draft trip to go to the Far East. This is interesting. There were 12 of us and a chief. and our draft was an advance party for the British Pacific Fleet, which at that time wasn't out in the Pacific. We had to go to Sydney. We left Plymouth, went up to Glasgow on train. We joined a liner, the Ile-de-France. Ile-de-France was the French prize, you know, had the Atlantic Blue Ribbons and all that sort of thing. So we went on this magnificent liner, although they boarded up all the pretty bits, and went across to the States, across the Atlantic. No escort, because she was fast on her own, like the QE and QM. So I went across the Atlantic. There was lots of Yanks on board going back home from being in Europe. And so it was an American man ship. So we go down to the mess to, you know, you think we're going to sit at these tables like you do, maybe. And you get a tray given to you. You queue up with this tray and go past, and there's all this stuff there you can choose from. Ice cream, Coca-Cola, what's Coca-Cola? We didn't know what Coca-Cola was, and so we were having that, and they'd have it all on these sections in the trays, and also, I mean, we hadn't had ice cream for years, and all sorts of, I can't remember what, you know, goodies, you know, chicken, really, you know, good, so we enjoyed that, and it took about 8 days or something, well, I can't remember, we got across to Boston, went down from Boston to New York, Grand Central Station, wow. Went into American Navy Barracks, Pier 92, and it was probably about a week before Christmas. So we went ashore and had these what they call them, USO, United Services Organizations, were like, I don't know what you call them now, look after servicemen, you know. So I went up there and said, we got invited to all sorts of college dues and all that, plenty of girls there, and different things like that.
How did the organisation of an American barracks differ from a British naval barracks, if at all?
In essence, I can't recall any particular, you know, difference. No, we were put this group of us. 12 plus 1, we're pretty much on our own, you know, we made our own rules, as it were. I mean, we weren't under any American discipline, unless there were any specific things that had to be, you know. I can't recall any major differences.
Were you all signalmen?
No, half and half. Half telegraphers, half signalmen. Because another thing that signalmen do, bless you. You all right? Another thing that the signal branch do is they run the signal office, the communications office, like for distributing signals. You get one copy of a signal and it's got to be issued to the different people who are relevant. So that's why we were a signal when we were there, not for communicating Morse, but for dealing with the distribution. You used to call it signal distribution office, and was always manned by signalmen on big ships. Little ships didn't have them. So yes, we were there at Pier 92. We could come and go as we wanted to, which was good. And we really, really did well. And I got what they call up homers over Christmas and went out to New Rochelle, just outside New York. And it was snowing. And as we drove up to where we had to go near Rochelle, there was a lake, there was all these fir trees with snow. It was like straight off a screen, you know. And this big house, there were two of us invited, and there was a man and his wife and two young kids, I think. And we had this Christmas dinner, and they really looked after us.
What did you call the process? by which you came by this invitation?
USO, United Services Organization. It's an American thing. They had them, like we had our NAFI and all, and YMCAs and all that, and that USO was their thing, you know.
So did they find families who...
Oh, yes. Well, yes, they did. They you know, got hold of people, and we were invited to all sorts, you know. Everyone wanted a British sailor, you know. We were great demand. It was great. So, yeah, so we had a Christmas there, and then after Christmas, we... This is another good bit. We got on a train, a Pullman, you know, like the Pullman first class with the, all the polished, worn up bunks that come down with the. With the Negro porter, you know, for each carriage. And so we got on this train. And we went from New York to Buffalo, across Niagara Falls, into Canada, down to Chicago. And from there we went through all the western towns like Cheyenne, Grand Rapids, Denver, and all the places you heard of in the films then, you know, the cowboy towns and all that. And most of them we'd stop, and you'd stop and you open the door, and the ground was about 4 or 5 feet below you, was the steps to go down. There was no sort of platform, you know, that. And you'd go there, get off, and you could walk into the town. And you had a couple of hours or something, and you'd come back, and we'd go off again. All these places that were named in the cowboys, you know, it was quite fascinating. Went over the Rockies, down into Reno, and into Oakland. And then across Oakland Bay to San Francisco. And so we got to San Francisco on New Year's Eve. And again, we were invited out to New Year's Eve parties and all that. So it was really great. What a trip. We were supposed to be in a war. So we stayed in San Francisco for about 2 weeks, living it up. But there was an officer, a liaison officer there from the British Army. He used to come out and give us bundles of dollars and, you know, did no recording, just so we could do whatever we want to and be sort of entertained. And God, it was fantastic. Then we eventually, we were on a waiting list to fly out to the Pacific. We went out to Honolulu, Hawaii, in what was a C-54 plane, and that was the first time I've ever flown. And we landed in Hawaii. And I remember going in the Royal Hawaiian Hotel and the Moana Hotel on Waikiki Beach and having lunch or something or whatever. There was two or three of us, if I remember, but just standing on Waikiki Beach in the middle of a war time seemed something unusual. And then we started hopping over the islands and Dakotas, and that got sort of worse then because it was, you know, sort of war. And eventually we got down, having gone through New Guinea, and got to Northern Australia, Townsville. Then we got, I think we flew down to Brisbane.
What do you mean when you say it got worse?
Well, we were an unknown entity. No one knew anything about us. No one wanted to know anything about us, and we had to keep queuing up for priorities on trains and on planes and going from all the different islands. I don't know, we made about 6 stops to get down from Hawaii to Australia. And some of these were like Johnson Island and Marshall. So, I mean, the war was still going on. And we were just landed in the middle of this. And we had our chief tell with us. He'd done all the negotiating and everything else. And I know we were put up in tents by the New Zealanders at one time. We were getting short of clothes, so they, most of them kitted us out. And we finished up in Sydney Central Station. Every single one of us had different gear on, and we looked like a proper lot of shipwrecks, you know. Oh, it was quite a trip to be. We were going out to war. And of course, the sad thing was, we got out there after the fleet. We were supposed to be a dance party. We went out to what was called Warwick Farm. It was a race course. A lot of people will know of this Warwick Farm in Sydney, the race course. There we were under canvas. And then we went into lodgings in Sydney and opened a communication, or joined a communication office that was being manned by civilians then, because we hadn't got out there. And so we did that for a little while. And then a couple of months, I think, then I was flown up to Manus, which was an advanced Admiralty Islands forward base for the Pacific Fleet for going up onto the operations.
So when would that have been?
1945, beginning.
Mm.
Yeah, so we've been on Manus for about 6 to 9 months, something to the end of the war. I was on Manus for VJ Day and also for VE Day. And the time we got back down to Sydney, everyone had forgotten the war. We didn't have any celebrations for the end of the war. Manus was a jungle island, and we were in Nissen huts and depended on the Americans for food and things like that.
And what were you doing exactly?
Communications office, you know, like SDR, signal distribution office. And because we used to get teleprinters there and get all the top secret stuff coming in from the American forces and all this, that and the other, we, you know, had a good idea what's going on in the war.
And did the signal change, or did the codes or have you changed?
Oh yes. I mean, we had what was it called? Not Type-X. Yeah, Type-X. Yeah, we had this machine. It was like a glorified typewriter, comptometer, and had the different wheels in it. And well, you've seen them on the television, I'm sure. If you type it in, it all comes out in code, and we transmit the code, and the other end breaks it down and reads it. And then, you know, we distribute the signal amongst the people involved. We ran the Manus Admiral Towers at one of the deepest harbours in the sort of general area in the Pacific. So all the big ships and convoys came in there, and a lot of communication all the time about supplies and everything else.
So you'd be distributing the new codes and signals, which would change how often?
24 hours, normally.
And
midnight.
You distribute them how?
Well, by hand, 9 times out of 10, because we're all being in an area together, or someone would go around with them by hand, you know, a junior would.
But how would you communicate, for example, ships out at sea, the new signals?
Through wireless telegraphy, if it was coded anyway, so that would be the main source. Or in some cases, from island to island by teleprinter.
I think, am I right in thinking that as a signal, you had
kind of
the official secret
set? No. I think that was sort of taken for granted, or sort of within the terms of your being. I don't know. I never signed an official secret act. No.
Anything else you'd like to tell me about your time on Manus?
Pardon?
Anything else about your time on Manus?
Yeah. Again, we were 4 hours on and 4 hours off. It was, you know, watch keeping right through the day and night. Wherever I've been in the service now, it always seemed to have a good spirit de corps. I built a boat. There was a river there that came out onto the beach, and I got some plywood and that, and just a simple boat, and we had some paddles, and we paddled up this river, and it came out into a pool with a big waterfall coming down, just like on the films, you know, Dorothy Lamour and all that lot. So that was a laugh. What else happened there? We had an entertainment ship came down there to entertain the fleet. What else?
Tell me about that.
Well, they just used to have shows, you know, we had them on the, often these shows would travel around the island, but then this entertainment ship didn't just have that. You know, the shows and that, they had all sort of drink and, you know, like clubs and that sort of thing. Quite interesting. That was Yankee, of course. Yeah, so we had a... that was the other thing. Yeah, I don't know how it originated, but I said, we often when we were off watch board or something too, so I said, well, let's have a charade. Let's have a mock wedding. Long looks faces. So I'm going to cut the story short. We had one guy, big fella, he was the groom. Another fella was the bride, and the bridesmaid, and the best man, and the vicar. I was the vicar. And we all dressed up. We had somewhere in the house, I don't know how, because it's all in the loft now. Other photos of these matlows all dressed up for the wedding. Silly thing, but it passed the time away. That's sort of easiest too. You know, you never allowed yourself to get bored. Or then, of course, you'd play cards. Told you I was initiated before I joined the Navy.
Was there gambling involved?
Yeah, this was when I was on the Drury in Belfast. Went out on one trip and I won £21. That's a lot of money in it. Playing pontoon, I think. And when I come back, I was going around with an Irish girl. Quite serious, you know, we've been going about 6 months. And so I said, will you marry me? She said, yes. So I went out and bought a diamond ring. Out of me winnings. But it didn't do me any good because I was then sent out to the Far East. And I said to her, look, I've got no idea how long we're going out there for, what's going to happen. I said, I'm not going to swear here and now that I'm going to be completely faithful or not, because I don't know what's going to happen. I will try to be, but I thought it was a bit daft saying that anyway. But I think the communication of the letters got, my letters got less and less, and in the end I said, it's all, you know, I can't. Blah blah blah, and I gather from her mother she threw a diamond ring in the fire. I don't know what good that did. Anyway, it was very sad. I can't brag about it, but that's what happened. You know, you're going out to the Far East where the war's still on, and you don't know, like these guys out there now, they don't know when it's going to end. And but I had two good girls out there. One I got sort of engaged to without a ring, the other one was quite sweet. One was in Sydney and the other one was in Melbourne. So I had sort of one in each port, as it were.
And would you go to those towns on leave?
Yeah. Well, I went to Melbourne on a course when I went done the course for Yeoman. In Sydney, I was in the Warwick Farm camp anyway. And in Sydney they had what they called the British Centre, and this is another one like the USO. In the war, particularly, there are always these groups and things that organise themselves for the entertainment or comfort of servicemen and all this, that and the other. So I got a leave, I think it was the weeks or whatever, to a place called Trundle in New South Wales near the Blue Mountains. And we went out, it was four of us, didn't know the other at all. We went out on a train to this place, and they told us, said, well, you know, just get off the train and go into the, I think they called it the town. So I said, yeah, but how will we know you? Where will we meet you? He said, don't matter, just get off the train, we'll find you. And it was like a cowboy town, like the pavements, or what they call sidewalks, were all wood, you know, and with hitching rails, and or really right out in the wilds. And so we walked about and walked up and down this street, or road on the street, and they found us and went out to their ranch. It was quite huge. From where the house was in the farmhouse was in the centre, to the first boundary where they had their post box. That was a mile. So anyway, we started riding horses.